But first, it's Wednesday and time for a weekly discussion of the latest in state politics with the Dakota Political Junkies. With us today is John Hunter, publisher of the Madison Daily Leader. And John, thanks for joining the program.
Thanks, Carl.
Also with us on the line is Seth Tupper, reporter for the Rapid City Journal. And Seth, thanks for your time.
You bet.
Well, last Friday, Governor Dugard signed the $7.50 youth minimum wage bill, which is a dollar less than the minimum wage approved by voters in November. The governor said that he didn't think the measure was an affront to the will of the voters because the campaign focused on adult workers who support a household and not on teenagers. And John Hunter, do you agree with the governor?
That's a loaded question right away. How did we get started with that?
Well, what do you think? Well, I mean, what are your thoughts on that bill?
Well, I think the governor is probably right in saying that the focus of the campaign was really on adults who would support a family, and that was much of the argument. Part of the question is, and I think there's perception and reality, and that is, if the voters pass something, should it be modified quickly after that? And I think most voters who supported that would say, yeah, they shouldn't change it right away, and that's essentially what this is doing. So it's possible that the authors of this, had they been approached a year and a half ago when they put this together, might have considered that kind of youth minimum wage bill. But and really, the truth is, in this kind of initiative process, it's a law like any other law that the legislature would pass, and it can be legally changed. There's nothing illegal about this. But I think supporters of this believe that the will of the people is being usurped right away.
Seth Tupper, what are your thoughts?
I would agree, and I'd say, you know, the people that voted for this and the people that put it on the ballot, you know, I mean, I would call it probably mildly irritating in that, you know, it certainly does roll back a small piece of what was gained by the ballot measure, but in the great constellation of people's fears and anxieties and worries, the idea that, you know, a 15-year-old kid's going to get paid a dollar less than an adult probably isn't ranking that high up there. So, you know, it's probably one of those things. I don't think any further action will arise out of it. It's, you know, again, while it's mildly irritating, I think the people that supported that ballot measure probably look at it and say, well, you know, he won a little battle and we won the war.
So, Seth, you don't think that supporters of a youth minimum wage would get another referendum on the ballot?
I sure don't think so, because I just don't think there'd be, you know, the critical mass you'd need to support something like that. It just doesn't seem to rise to the level of great statewide concern that you'd need to, you know, really get a ballot measure passed.
Yeah, John Hunter?
I agree with Seth, and with the possible exception that there might be some time when, if there's a sweeping increase in minimum wages across the country, you know, South Dakota is actually kind of in the top third now of the higher minimum wage among all states. But if there's some sweeping thing that causes it to be higher, they could attach that to another increase at another time. But I think what's maybe more likely is that there might be something done at the federal level rather than at the state level.
The governor last Friday also signed the petition reform bill, Senate Bill 69. There are a lot of different elements to this bill, but critics, including the National Centrist Project, focus on one thing in particular, and that's that they say that this will make it harder for independent candidates to get on the ballot. And Seth, I don't know if you've been watching this bill or reading it very closely, but I'm wondering what impact do you think this will have on getting independents on the ballot? Will it make it harder, as critics say?
Well, it certainly seems like it would, because it would increase the signature requirements. And, you know, you look at the bill and you have to wonder if this wasn't politically motivated. I'm not sure what the motivation was. I mean, it certainly seems to make it more difficult for, you know, Democrats and independents to do a number of things against Republicans. Now, you know, that's what happens when one party controls the legislature. They tend to get their way. But, you know, besides making it, you know, increasing the petition signatures, one of the more interesting things I thought about the bill was, you know, it requires kind of a higher standard for somebody to drop off the ballot. And what that means is in a lot of districts, Democrats have trouble recruiting candidates. And So what they'll do is somebody will put their name on the ballot, hoping that before the deadline to drop off, they'll convince somebody else to take their place. And that's a fairly common practice, among Democrats especially, because there's fewer Democrats and they have a harder time recruiting. So this bill puts in some new requirements that you'd have to meet before you could drop off the ballot, which of course, since Democrats are the ones who use that practice the most, it would hurt them. So again, it certainly seems like it makes things life easier for Republicans.
John Hunter, what do you think the impact will be of this bill?
Well, I think it will trigger other reforms later on. You know, this the bill was changed a lot. There were a fair number of amendments and lots of striking out and adding and that sort of thing. So I'm not sure that by the time it got to its final position, it's exactly where people wanted it. The question is, again, as Seth is describing, that would have to come from a Republican legislator or a support of the Republican portion of the legislature in order to get that done. It would be hard for that kind of thing to occur either by Democrats or by a referendum or petition process. But I think there's going to be more and more reforms to the election process in all forms in coming years.
Do you see that happening too as well, Seth, that this will lead to various reforms?
Well, I don't know. I mean, you know, obviously the people that want to roll back what just happened would be Democrats and independents and minor party candidates, and, you know, not having any power in the legislature would be tough for them to do that. I don't know. Certainly, as we saw this session, if Republicans want to make changes, they can do that whenever they want because they have the numbers and they have the governor to sign the bill.
Well, veto day is coming up on Monday, which will essentially wrap up the work of the 2015 session. Looking at Monday, John Hunter, do you expect much to happen?
Well, they'll certainly debate the different vetoes that the governor had, and so how strongly they will debate, it's hard to say. But all three of them that I looked at, you know, were to make minor changes to taxation. And so there aren't huge items here of kind of statewide interest, but rather narrow interest. So I think they'll debate them. Whether they override or not, I don't know.
And Seth Tupper, what do you expect to happen on Monday?
Yeah, as John said, I mean, these are pretty relatively obscure tax bills that the governor vetoed that kind of deal with a small slice of the population. And so, you know, you would expect from that, you know, to override a governor's veto on something like that would be pretty tough because there just aren't very widespread in their impact. So you never know. I mean, they'll debate it, but it certainly doesn't seem like that these would be the kind of bills where the veto would be overridden.
Any quick summary of the 2015 session, John Hunter? Last week, we were talking about it with the junkies, the guests last week. They mentioned, essentially called it a meat and potatoes session. What are your thoughts?
I think so, too, and one of those factors is the fact that appropriations kind of dominates that eventually anyway. You know, you can pass bills and you can do all sorts of things, but unless it involves appropriations. So I think to get the highway bill was actually a pretty big deal, and you know, that for many years we've been talking about highway funding, and so it actually got done. So I think that's a notable thing. The juvenile judicial reform, I think, was, you know, a bit of a fait accompli that was going to happen once it was introduced. So, but nothing I don't think out of the ordinary of what legislatures would do, and anything particularly unusual. I think there was still some cooperation. You know, there the session before, I think legislators kind of remarked on how well everyone was getting along, and maybe it wasn't quite so much this time, but still maybe above average.
How about for you, Seth? Any final thoughts on the 2015 session?
Well, I think, you know, the highway and road funding bill was a big focus, and I thought that was really interesting to watch because we had a Republican-controlled legislature and a Republican governor that passed through a broad package of tax and fee increases. The last number I saw, I think, was $85 million. You know, that's a big tax and fee increase for a supposedly conservative body to be enacting. And I think it shows, and it just reflected, that in South Dakota there's a strong strain of sort of pragmatic, moderate conservatism, and a lot of people that are willing to, you know, do things you wouldn't think a conservative normally would do when the time is right and when the need calls for it. And you know, this road and bridge funding bill was a product of many years of work and a lot of persistence by some legislators, and it finally got through. And you know, something that maybe wouldn't happen in states where maybe the conservative is a little more harder core, or maybe the more extreme elements have more control over the legislature.
One more thought on that, yes. Carl, too, is that Governor Dugard really kind of waited until he had all, and I don't know if anyone saw the presentation he was making about this highway funding, but it in a way was as conservative as he normally is, and he was talking about the money spent now kind of categorically would save money in the future by how much roads deteriorate. And I was a bit surprised in how much data had been gathered and so forth. They had these trucks that go across the state and photograph and measure the deterioration of roads. And so, you know, he's done a few things in the last couple of years where he would be paying, you know, take money now and pay off long-term debt and so forth. And I think that's a little bit on how this framed. So in one way, it was another conservative approach to that. But again, as Seth pointed out, it's when you see the dollar figure, it kind of startles you from a Republican point of view.
Well, moving on beyond the session, a name that we heard a lot last year, was in the news late last week, former Democratic U.S. Senate candidate Rick Wyland, along with Dre Samuelson, former chief of staff to retired Senator Tim Johnson, have formed a nonprofit advocacy group and political action committee. It uses Wyland's Senate campaign slogan, "Take It Back." And Seth Tupper, what is the goal of this political group?
What they say, from what I saw and read, seemed to be that, I mean, I think what I took from it, from their announcement, was that it's a continued and further outgrowth reaction to you know, the growth of money in politics and the Citizens United decision. And the idea that they pitched when they rolled this out, this new effort, was that they want to work against money in politics. Of course, many people would point out the irony of, you know, to battle against money in politics, you got to form a PAC and raise money to do it. That seems to be what's going on. And, you know, I don't know. I haven't talked to Rick Wyland, but I would suppose part of it is it's a way to stay in the political game and have some influence. And some of it is, I think he is probably a true believer, and most of his Senate campaign was geared toward, you know, being against big money and talking about the influence of big money on politics. So it seemed like that's what they're going to work on, is maybe try to roll back some of to try to use the influence of a PAC to try to roll back some of the loosened restrictions on money in politics.
Rick Wyland says this is a nonpartisan group. John Hunter, given his background in the Democratic Party, will this group be perceived as independent?
Well, not yet. Certainly with both Rick and Dre Samuelson, it'll be perceived, I think, right away as a Democratic thing. I think Rick would like it to be to get support from both sides, and he may have success in that. But I think it's that has work yet to be done. At its launch, it'll still be perceived as a continuation of the Senate campaign, which is used a lot of party principles, Democratic Party platform items across the way. So if he wants it to be nonpartisan, there'll be a fair amount of work yet to get to that point.
John, do you think the group will have much impact? Is it hard to say at this point?
You know, I think they both have a lot of contacts with a lot of different people, mostly in Washington, I think, so that I think they can get some support for that, but whether they can get enough to battle the fights that they want to fight, I don't know yet.
And Seth, what do you think it'll take to or even in general, what does it take to get a political action group, a political group like this off the ground?
Well, money, I guess.
Money. It all comes down to money again.
The short word, you know, I mean, I think they want to do messaging and they want to do activism and all that kind of thing takes money. And, you know, I'd be skeptical of the impact, just like I'd be of anything, just because the political landscape is just littered with these kinds of advocacy groups that have an agenda and are raising money. And, you know, to stand out from the crowd, you know, it will take a lot of work and a lot of money, I would imagine.
Yesterday, Senator John Thune announced that the Federal Aviation Administration approved a plan to expand the bomber training area over the Dakotas, Montana, and Wyoming. The expanded Powder River Training Complex nearly quadruples the training airspace. Since that's out in your neck of the woods, Seth, what does this mean for Ellsworth Air Force Base?
Well, really, it's really big news, and you know, people out here, I think what the context in which they're considering this is they're going back 10 years ago when Ellsworth was on the base closure list, and back then, of course, there were people, including Senator Thune and his office, that took a look and wanted to find out what could we do to you know, keep Ellsworth off future closure lists. And one of the things that they came up with was to expand the airspace that's attached to Ellsworth, the training airspace, and then that began a 9-year effort on the part of both Senator Thune's office and other people, other members of the congressional delegation and locals. And it was a long, drawn-out process, but yesterday's approval announcement by the FAA seems to be the last thing that was needed, and it's going to nearly quadruple the training space available to Ellsworth, and there'll be other military installations that can come in and use that as well. And so the thought or the hope is that, you know, this is a big piece of solidifying Ellsworth's future and keeping it off a closure list. And as some people reminded me yesterday, there's no guarantee of that, but it's certainly at least something that people at Ellsworth can hang their hat on to you know, try to show the federal government that the base should be kept open for the long term.
And Seth, what are the critics saying about this expansion, particularly the environmental impacts?
Well, there's really two levels of criticism. One is a really localized concern among a lot of people in, you know, eastern Montana, especially, that are worried about, you know, increased flights over ranches and towns and the impact on local aviation. And there's no doubt, I mean, it will be an irritation at some times, but the part of the process was a long, drawn-out review in which thousands of public comments were taken and the plan was modified, and so the Air Force, you know, has said they're going to try to do their best to mitigate those concerns. Then, of course, the other level of concern is on a national and global scale, people saying that, well, you know, is advocating for the base in your own backyard just because you want it there and you want the economic impact, is that necessarily doing what's best for, you know, defense as a whole and strategic and doing what's strategically best for the country? So, you know, there's this kind of two levels of criticism. Locally here in Rapid City, though, of course, people are thinking there's thousands of people employed by Ellsworth. They want to keep that local. They want to keep it open, and they want to keep that economic impact.
John Hunter, looking at this issue from the perspective of Senator John Thune and even Senator Mike Rounds, what does this mean for them, and particularly when you look at John Thune running for re-election in a couple of years, or next year, that's next year, isn't it?
Well, both Rounds and Thune were involved in that BRAC closure process that Seth was referring to, so they're both familiar with it all the way through, and I think they're probably both thinking in terms of solidifying Ellsworth as a long-term player. That's part of the strategy, is you keep improving and adding. You know, Senator Johnson did the same thing too when he was able to move some of the financial things to a new office building there as well. But the more activity and the more investment you make in a place, then it would increase its likelihood to stay open. So I think it'll play well with South Dakotans, you know, if you're talking about a re-election kind of thing. But, you know, I think Senator Thune may face no competition in any sense at his next election.
All right. Well, that'll have to do it for the Dakota Political Junkies this week. John, thanks for joining us.
Thanks, Carl.
And Seth, thanks for joining the program as well, and happy birthday to you.
Thank you.
Seth Tupper is a reporter for the Rapid City Journal, and John Hunter is publisher of the Madison Daily Leader. The Dakota Political Junkies are a regular Wednesday feature of Dakota Midday.